I have a theory, Quinn, and it's that the electricity in your house is haunted or poisoned.
What makes you say that?
Well, I've plugged two computers into your house this week, and both ones have started acting very strange, and then we sat down to record this, and your computer started acting strange. And I'm just saying, wouldn't it explain it if the electricity was haunted?
Oh, like I have like an electric ghost type, like a Rotom in my house?
I think you got Rotoms, dog. I think there are Rotoms in your shit.
I'm pretty okay with that if that is the case. I've never really gotten a chance to play with Rotom too much. It was usually more like a late game Pokemon. My team was usually decided by that point in time. So this would be an opportunity to get like some new experience in there, definitely. I like that.
You're such an optimist.
When it comes to Pokemon.
Normally when I tell people they have a Rotom in their shit, they're immediately calling a priest. They're, you know, drowning people in holy water. It's a whole fiasco.
I don't call priests unless they come dressed up in like latex or something like that. There's just not, I don't have that need in my life otherwise.
Well, that's the other show we do. We'll do BDSM Corner after this episode.
Whoa, wait, we have a BDSM podcast now?
I know you do. We have an episode. What's it called? Was it just called like the Dom episode or something?
That was just because we had to talk about stuff that was BDSM adjacent. This is a podcast I want where we just talk about BDSM. And I can talk about getting cigarette burned by a nun in latex.
I bet that's a saturated market. I've never checked, but surely there are a bunch of podcasts in that niche, right? That's not being undefended.
I'll tell you right now, I do have one BDSM podcast. I don't know why I said it that way. BDSM podcast on my thing. It's just conversations with the Dom, which it doesn't work the same way. It's British. I don't know. They do shit differently over there. But I haven't honestly like dug into it, if only because I find delving into podcasts without getting a recommendation on them first is like a punishment. Like that's like a cruel thing you do to somebody because there's so much garbage out there. So I just assumed if there is a huge market that like most markets in podcasting, a lot of it's pretty bad.
Yeah, it's 90% people who don't know how to edit their audio. Like 5% of people who have really good audio, but they're like corporate captured. You know, it's all just ads for NordVPN or whatever, and then there's like the 5% of that's good enough but not corporate slop. It's such a hard thing to find.
And then you just find some stuff you're like, this is technically good, but I just don't jive with it. Like I don't gel with the people who are talking or whatever. So we should note, by the way, for the fact that we were just commenting on audio quality, that Austin will sound a little bit different this episode. That is because he is in Harrisburg, and he is using my Yeti microphone that I think I purchased sometime back in like 2011 or something like that. So this is an older mic, and I think its quality it stands on it.
2011 is so funny. Think back on those times. Can you even imagine what we were like back then? People were just letting their whole ass out onto the social media. We were laughing our fucking tits off at the angry video game nerd. Oh, what a time it was.
I feel like people put more of their ass on social media nowadays, but I do get what you mean.
Not their physical ass. No, it's an ass's paradise now. It's nothing but ass bots. But I meant just be like people just saying the R slur, you know, just putting it all out there.
Racists and shitheads. Yeah, that sure. I guess there's that. They're still there. That's Twitter now. It's still there. You just can't say the slurs. You have to dog whistle everything out.
I think you can kind of say the slurs now. It's, regardless, this is a different conversation. We were winding up to, I sound different. I'm in Harrisburg. It's been a nightmare week. This is not only just an audio. My voice probably sounds different because I think I'm sick as well. So I'm not going to spend this whole episode complaining, but I do want to give everyone an update because there's not going to be a normal Dice Funk episode in the feed on Sunday. There still will be an upload because there's always an upload every Sunday until I die, until the cruel Reaper finally cuts me off this mortal coil, as he's obviously trying to do. Fuck.
Poor Austin. I don't love that it's the week from hell happens to be coinciding with the week you spent with me.
Uh-huh. I don't know if it's your fault necessarily.
What do you mean it's not necessarily my fault? It should be 100% not my fault. I made you Sonic chili.
You did, and we should talk about the Sonic cookbook. But I think that the culprit is probably a combination of airport slime, airport ooze, and airport goo, because I was trapped in the Orlando airport for, I believe, 20-ish hours. It was not good. There was a tornado, and I know what you're thinking. Austin, I didn't see in the news that a plane was eaten by a tornado, so I think you're okay. And yes, physically okay, but emotionally, am I? Probably not.
Well, you were in an airport. You got there around like 10 o'clock or so in the morning, I want to say, and then found out your flight was canceled a little after noon, and then had to re-scramble to find a new flight someplace else, and then that flight also got delayed, and then eventually you had to go get food, and that's when you learned a delightful fact.
Oh, yes. This is my odyssey in the Orlando airport. So every food place was absolutely jam-packed with, you know, sunburned tourists, specifically Chick-fil-A and Burger King, neither of which I'm a fan of anyway. I just thought it was very interesting. If you wanted that, you would have had to stand in like a multi-hour line as it wrapped around the entire concourse. So I was like, I'll just go to whatever restaurant has the lowest line. And it turns out there is a French restaurant in the Orlando airport, and it's not like a sit-down restaurant. It's still a Burger King, I guess, but it is in the French style, in a la mode, I believe. And you can just walk up and get something because no one wants that shit in Florida, which I think is very funny. And I looked at their menu, and I was like, yeah, I'll just take the, you know, the whatever the French equivalent of a cheeseburger is, the croque monsieur. I've heard that before. And then I had airport madness. I'd been sitting there for 12 hours. And so I just idly Googled, what does croque monsieur mean? And I just started laughing like the fucking Joker as I learned it literally translates to the crunch gentleman. And I was fully losing it. I was surprised security wasn't called.
Yeah, I didn't get to see, obviously, this part of it. You were still in Orlando, but after you did arrive the next day, essentially, we went out to lunch with some friends, and you were very much still very Joker-pilled. what you found funny was different, but it was very much a level of like, exhaustion has gotten to Mr. Yorsky.
Yeah, that experience changed me. It's like Stephen King's The Jaunt. It is longer than you think. I don't know how much of that story will be interesting because, yeah, there's a bunch of different delays and weather stuff. Who cares about most of that, though? The important thing is that I got to Harrisburg, plugged my computer in, excited to finish editing the new episode of Dice Funk, and my computer didn't turn on. And then I started coughing up vile mucuses, and everything hit at once. So it's been pretty bad, but I did reach out to the, you know, the Dice Funk listening audience. If you're hearing this, you're among the beautiful elect of people who are paying attention to the show. And so when I asked people to chip in to help me fix my computer situation, everyone was very generous and helped. And obviously, I'm recording on a computer now. That's why you're hearing this. You're hearing my voice. So thank you so much to everybody who helped. Yeah. I'm probably just going to put this episode in the main feed on Friday when I record it, just so that if you only listen to the show in this feed, you'll probably be like, why is there not a normal episode? And then you'll know. Does that make sense? Am I just, yeah. I'm just like spinning in my head.
No, makes a lot of sense. Plus that way the people who aren't patrons but did support also get an update as to what's going on. Because, I mean, if we were to have recorded a regular episode of Dice Funk and then that's the way you learned, you wouldn't learn about it until sometime in July-ish or whatever. So,
sure.
There's something there to that. And it is also worth noting that the mic quality is not a symptom of the computer. That is a symptom of the mic, which should be back to normal once you return back to Florida and you have all of your regular recording equipment back with you.
That is the dream. Yeah, that's what's, I hope it's going to happen. This will be like an unlocked Spewpunk. So if you've never heard of Spewpunk before and you're like, I want to hear Quinn and Austin talk about BDSM or Fallout or whatever.
Well, you have to start supporting me to get my sideshow made. I don't know what I'll call it yet. BDSM show.
Nope. See, that's the kind of things that we need the Patreon dollars to refine, you know?
Okay.
Because if we just try to do it raw, you can tell it's not very good.
Oh, spit in my mouth.
Okay.
The Quinn show.
All right, that's a pretty good first draft. I got to say, I'm looking at the focus group. They're nodding. One of them's got their hand in their pants. Knock that off.
You know what? Hey, let them go. Let them go.
That's useful feedback.
Yeah.
So we are going to talk about some of the stuff we normally talk about on Speedpunk. The thing I came up here to do with you, which is the Outlaws of Thunder Junction pre-release. We also saw some movies. We'll try to get this in under an hour, both because I am very ill and because we're going to do a better one as soon as I get a better mic. So we'll be back very soon.
Yeah, but there's stuff obviously we got to talk about before it's completely gone from our head, which is why we should probably start with Outlaws of Thunder Junction, which you might say, Quinn, that was only a week ago or so. Like, how much could it possibly have left your mind? I currently have the MTG previews page up because I've forgotten about half the cards in my deck. So a week is an eternity for me. So let's talk about that a bit while this is still somewhat fresh in our minds.
Wowzers, Bowsers. It has been a full week. Huh? I didn't even realize. Friday to Friday, huh?
Yep.
So both you and I have been on, I think, undefeated streaks at sealed events for a couple months now. And I don't know if you want to give away the results right up front, but I think we did pretty good. You and so when we opened our cards, I want to say you had a pretty public meltdown of you being like, I'm fucked. I'm ruined. I'm not going to win a game, let alone a match. I'm not going to make my colors. I'm screwed. Kill me now. And I was like, fuck all y'all. I'm going to dominate your butts.
You were taunting about the cards you weren't playing because they weren't good enough for your deck. You were like, get this shit out of here. Can't even play it. Sorry, is that a mythic? Who cares? Can't fit in my deck.
Yeah, I opened Oko, the Planeswalker of the set, and the Simic, which is in the same colors, the Simic Paul Bunyan character. Do you remember her name off the top of your head? Bonnie Paul, I think it is.
I think Bonnie Paul is the card. And we talked about this on Spewpunk in that this card is absolutely gross. Bonnie Paul Clear Cutter, which is a 6/5 for 6 mana that has reach. And when it enters the battlefield, you make an ox that has power and toughness equal to the number of lands you control, which should be at least 6. If you're paying 6 mana to cast this, there could be treasures or whatever, but should be like a 5/5 or a 6/6 or something. So for 6 mana, you're getting like 11 worth of power between two bodies. And then Bunny Paul also just has another ability that says, whenever you attack, draw a card. Then you can put a land card from your hand or graveyard onto the battlefield. She doesn't even have to attack. You're probably going to attack with her because she's 6/5, but just whenever you attack. Fucking bonkers ass card. And you're like, no, don't need it.
Yeah, those are my two first opens. And I was like, well, obviously I'm in Simic then because these are really good cards. But I just did not get any other blue or green playables, just like real dog shit. So I actually ended up pivoting to Rakdos, red and black, because I got a couple of really good cards there. Most notably, Akul, the Unrepentant, the villain of Outlaws of Thunder Junction, the Scorpion Dragon. If you haven't seen any art of this guy, I highly recommend it. It's really cool. It's Akul, A-K-U-L. Just a great design for these, basically like horse scorpion dragons. Really cool.
Yeah, very, very cool. And I ended up, my pre-release card was the Gitrog monster, the Gitrog Ravenous Ride, I think it's what it's called. And it is 3, a black and a green for a 6/5 with trample haste. It's also a saddle creature with saddle 1. It basically, if it deals combat damage, you can sacrifice the creature that saddled it. And if you do, you draw X cards, then put up to X land cards from your hand onto the battlefield tap, where X is the sacrifice creature's power. So if a creature with 3 power saddled it, you could sacrifice it, draw 3 cards, put 3 lands onto the graveyard or into the battlefield tapped. Seemed like a pretty solid card. And just honestly, 6/5 trample haste is such an absurd stat line for 5 that I was like, all right, let me try to make this work. I tried to build a Golgari deck. I did not have the green to support it. Like, my green was like very mediocre. I had like maybe 1 piece of removal in the colors. And a big part of this set is that every pack has a breaking news card, which are the cards in the newspaper style font. And many of those, all of them are crimes. All of them target something and will effectively commit a crime if you successfully cast them. But because of the way crimes work, a lot of them are like targeting things to kill them or to like disrupt. So they're like really good pieces of removal. And I was like, well, I have 2 pretty good pieces of removal in Simic. So maybe I could try to, and that's what I ended up building. I ended up building a Dimir deck that splashed for green for a couple cards. And I was really unsure of it. I did not think this deck looked particularly good. I felt like I was behind on quite a few things. I didn't think I had enough like good just removal spells. I had to run two of the black card that I think is like two mana. Give a creature -2/-2 until end of turn, but it gets +1 for each. It goes down an extra increment for every desert you controlled. And I had two total in my deck. And I was like, that is not a high value. Like this card's like highest ceiling is -4/-4, which I feel like in late game is going to be like kind of useless. So I was really unsure of that.
Desert's Dew is the name of that card.
Yeah. And I just didn't, there was a brief moment right before we started where I was like, maybe I take out all of the blue and green and I run Orzhov instead. Because I had like one or two cards in Orzhov and I was like, maybe this is what I have to do. But let me just roll with this first. And if I get shit stomped in my first round, I'll you know, swap out. It's not what happened. I ended up going undefeated in the pre-release. I still think that my deck was mostly, I don't want to say jank, but a couple cards overperformed that I didn't think they were going to. And I ended up getting lucky in a couple of my matches. My draws are very good, despite splashing for green. Outside of one game, I never really had trouble getting at least getting my colors. Like if I needed my green cards to win the game, I got one of my three ways of getting like a green source of mana, essentially. Mm. And the one game that I did get screwed on colors, it wouldn't even matter. I got screwed. I was a Dimir deck. And I think in the first seven turns of the game, I drew nothing but black mana sources. Like I think I had six of my like eight swamps on the field by the end of that game. And I was like, it's just game two, dude. I don't know what else to say. I can't play any of the cards in my hand anymore.
Yeah, but I mean, you ended up winning all your matches, and yes. I think for the second or third pre-release in a row, it's like a half-year winning streak, right? It's like every 2 or 3 months.
Sure. I mean, it's like the metrics are slow. Like the metrics are hard to read a little bit because we should note this. This was a pre-release that when we showed up, there was only one other person preparing to play. Thankfully, a bunch of other people did roll in. I think we ended up probably having about like 12 or so players, but this was lower in terms of player count than some of the previous ones, even Karloff's Manor, which was pretty low. So it wasn't like as huge of a group. But I mean, yeah, I did go up against three players and I won all my matches against them. So I do have to take some pride in that. I'll talk a little bit about, I guess, some of the cards that were good, but how did you do at the pre-release?
Yeah, so I audibled the last minute into a Rakdos Crime deck with Akul in the Hellspur Posse boss as kind of my higher end cards, and Kervek, the Punisher, who's like a classic magic villain who's come back after many years, who actually went off in a big way. So Crime is when you target your opponent's stuff. And then I had a bunch of cheap removal, and I got a couple of the breaking news cards like Unlicensed Hearse, which is technically a crime because it targets your opponent's graveyard. And so every turn I would just eat their graveyard. And then Kervek's ability is when you do a crime, you can cast something from your graveyard. And so I just made a really cruel crime machine where I got to play all my cards twice. It was really, good. And in the games I won, Kervek did work. The posse boss gave everything haste. I also had the black card, the spree card that lets you search your library for something, put it into your graveyard, and then return up to two creatures, mana value 4 or less, from your graveyard to the battlefield. Oh. So if you do the full spree, you can search Akul, put Akul into your graveyard, and then revive Akul from your graveyard all in one card. And then if you have the posse boss out, it has haste. So that's just an ass slapping out of nowhere, which I did a couple times. It's a great finisher. So I went 2-1 in my matches. I did not go undefeated. My streak is broken. My second match, I just got color and mana screwed. I just couldn't catch up. And the thing I was most impressed with, and this will come back because I did a couple drafts on Magic Arena after, but the thing I was most impressed with was mounts. which is a vehicle variant. Basically, it's a creature. It can attack and defend on its own, but if you tap something else to saddle it, you get a bonus. And I thought, like, yeah, it's a vehicle. I've played with vehicles before. No big deal. But the guy who ran my ass over did it with this card that is – it was like the Homestead is what the name of the card was. And it just turbo ramped. Every time it attacks while saddled, I think, or it's a vehicle as well, you get to like look at the top card of your library. If it's a land, you can put it onto the battlefield, and just was fully dumping their entire deck. It was so sick. And so when I drafted, as I'll talk about, I did a Naya and a Selesnya mounts and vehicles deck both times and ran the table, 7 wins on both on Arena.
Unstoppable. You can't beat him. Once you give the guy a little bit of time to learn it, he's untouchable.
Yeah. Well, once I figure out what the format's doing, and it is up to some interesting things. I think a lot of people are kind of down on this. Like you said, attendance was lower. It seems like people like the power level, which is high, but I don't know that many people are like, I can't wait until we come back to Thunder Junction. But I think I did figure out the format eventually, and I think it's pretty enjoyable. Although, yeah. Obviously, since I didn't go undefeated, it's not as good as the last couple.
That's exactly. Just objectively true. It's just kind of worse all around when you think about it a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
I had quite a few cards that I thought kind of performed really well. The one card that performed like crazy well for me was Rush of Dread. This is one of the spree cards. It's 1 double black, and then its modes are for 1 mana, they also your opponent sacrifices half the creatures they control rounded up. For 2 mana, they discard half the cards in their hand rounded up, or for another 2 mana, they lose half their life rounded up. And this card fucking puts in a disgusting amount of work. I thought it wouldn't be that good since your opponent gets to choose the creatures they sacrifice. So like they're always going to choose their worst creatures and you're stuck with like the hardest stuff afterwards. It's kind of expensive to lose half their life. But I found as like a late game card, it was really, really good. Sometimes just sacrificing one of their creatures was enough to make sure one of my things would get through unblocked. Losing half their life really cut down life totals at points, especially if you get them when like they've kind of been able to protect themselves most of the game and they go from like 18 health to 9 health suddenly or something like that. And then there was another card I had in my deck, Slickshot Lockpicker. This is one of the plot cards, which I'll talk about in a little bit. But this guy basically, when enters the battlefield, a card in your graveyard gets an instant sorcery gets flashback equal to its mana cost. So I would one turn play Rush of Dread, do all that stuff, then next turn Slickshot Lockpicker, then Rush of Dread again. And I think I don't think I ever actively killed someone with it as burn, but there were definitely times where I got people so close with the lose your life, half your life twice in a row that you just like poke through like 2 damage and it's enough to get the victory. So Rush of Dread, crazy good. And that's another one where like the modes get better on that redo. Because losing half your battlefield isn't great. Like, oh, I had 3 creatures. I lose my worst 2, but I still have my best creature. And then it's like, next turn I cast it again. Sacrifice your best creature.
Yeah, all the spree cards did super good work. I was telling you that I won multiple games from the white uncommon spree Rustler Rampage, where you untap all your creatures and give a creature double strike. So I would like alpha strike. They would think they're safe enough with their blocks. And then not only do I untap my whole team, but the one they let through is now hitting for twice the damage. And yeah, that just ended several games out of nowhere.
Yeah. And I think the other card I pulled out to showcase was Caustic Bronco. This is the 2/2. That when you attack with it, you reveal the top card of your library, lose life equal to its converted mana cost, put it into your hand. But if it's saddled, then your opponent loses life instead. This card is not great. It's 2 mana for a 2/2, which is fine. Like, you know, back in the day, this would have been the most powerful card in the entire set. But unfortunately, Magic in 2024 is a different beast. So it became untenable to block with pretty frequently. But as a way, if you could get it out on turn 2 and get like 2 attacks in, the value of just getting to draw 2 extra cards was worth it. I don't think I ever got it to the point where the saddling part was like relevant. But that was also like a win con in my deck was like, look, if I do draw this late and it survives, then I can attack with it, you know, saddle it, and then make it so my opponents lose life. And I had like a 7-mana spell on my deck, so I was like, there is just a chance I can like poke out the extra little bit of damage that way.
Yeah, it's funny that you mentioned the Slick Shot Lock Picker and the Caustic Bronco as being all-stars, because those are direct references to Snapcaster Mage and yes. Dark Confidant, two classically powerful creatures.
Yep.
I think those are actually both tournament winner cards. Like the thing Magic does is if you win like their biggest championship, they make a card with you as a character.
Yeah.
I think both Snapcaster and Dark Confidant are previous championship winners, and now they're a snake horse and a thief, respectively.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's funny.
There is, I did play the other one. There is one of those actually in this set, the Duelist of the Mind for Nathan Stewart, who is the world champion, I think, what, last year or something like that. It takes a little bit for these cards to actually come out. That card is a beast. It's a 2-mana star 3 with Flying and Vigilance, and its power is equal to the number of cards you draw on this turn, which should always be at least one. But you can also if you commit a crime, draw a card, which is like just kind of, you have to discard afterwards, but like that's also just kind of a gross ability. Just a 1/3 Flying Vigilance for 2 is just such a crazy stat line for a card. So very, very gross there. And then I had a couple pretty decent cards from the Breaking News set. I had Repulse in there. I had, oh gosh, I can't remember its name, Plasma Slime or something like that. It's a blue green, I think, and it's counter target spell activate ability or triggered ability. Void Slime, and that's just like a super good card in general. Maybe I didn't see it. Were there a lot of counter spells in this set?
No, there really wasn't. There's the Blue Spree where you can pay for the counter ability. And I think there's like one other one. But I actually noticed that. It seems like they're pulling back on counter magic because focus testing tells them people hate getting their shit countered.
Yeah, now looking at it, that having that as an availability, because there were definitely times where it's like, I can't let that happen. I'm going to counter that. That did save my bacon.
Yeah, there's another blue one where it's... I think you make a spirit or something, or you can spree it into a counter. But yeah, it's pretty thin on the ground there. Phantom Interference, counter target spell unless its controller pays 2 or pay 3 to create a white spirit creature token of flying. So yeah, that's that card.
But yeah, I found most of the cards were pretty good. Plot as a mechanic, I was super low on when it was first announced. I just didn't really get it, and I think it did just take me time to grok it, essentially, where it is inherently by itself still not particularly a good mechanic, but with the way they made a lot of like the enter the battlefield abilities work in this set does make it better, because there's a lot of stuff about like chaining cards together or gain a lot of extra value, and I got a lot of extra value by plotting out that Slick Shot Lock Picker and then casting it later when I did get an instant sorcery in my graveyard that was worth flashing back. Or Lone Shark was another one where it's like, ooh, this is a good card, but like if I do it next turn, then I get a draw card and we're kind of in a board stall anyway, so this is just, you know, extra value to not like force tempo forward or whatever. And one card I didn't talk about but I should that really put in work was Fibble Thip, Lost on the Range. I did not think this card would be that good at all. It's basically a look at the top card of your deck, and you may plot non-land cards on the top of it. If they don't have plot, it's equal to their mana cost. And I thought this card would not be very good. It's a 3-mana 1/1. But again, there were games where I drew like 4 or 5 cards off of this guy because I would just keep plotting cards off the top of my deck and then knowing I just cast them next turn, you know? So pretty good. As long as I didn't hit, an instant that's like, you know, if I hit Void Slime, I wasn't going to plot that out there because it's never going to be useful. But any stuff that's like, hey, this is sorcery speed removal, fuck it. Like next turn, it's out there. Like it's going to float, but I get to look at another card. It's a creature. I'll plot that out and then, you know, dig through a whole bunch of your deck that way. It was really good.
Yeah, I think one of the big stories coming out of this kind of period is that Slickshot show off. A red plot card is like a complete demon. You can win on like turn three if you plot properly.
Yeah.
With Monastery Swift Spear and Monstrous Rage and so forth. So that, yeah, the plot mechanic is definitely getting its recognition now. I always thought it was pretty cool, but yeah, now I think everyone's seeing the potential of it.
Yeah.
Other cards that from my drafts, my vehicle and mounts drafts, I gotta say, Full Steam Ahead, it's a sorcery speed combat trick. I almost didn't put it in my deck. It gives everyone 2/2 trample and can't be blocked by more than one creature. And I finished like half my games where I was like at a board stall and I was like, you know what? Train time. Choo-choo, motherfucker. Math is for blockers. Eat my ass. And it just, and that just overperformed there. And also Prairie Dog, which is a weird little card. It's a 2/2 for 2 lifelink. If you don't cast a spell, it gets a 1/1, which is fine. But then it has this ability, which basically turns it into a winding constrictor where you pay 5 and then it doubling seasons your counters. And that, it got silly because I had the green mount, the Ordinary Tumblewag, which gives a counter every turn, and then if it's saddled, doubles counter. So I was doubling my double counters. I had like gross. A 12-12 at one point. Yeah, the counter game was getting pedunculous at some point. So that really popped off in a big way. Yeah, I had a lot of fun. I won out both of my drafts and 2-3'd the sealed. So pretty good format. I had a couple of cards for my stuff, you know, Azorius Watch. There's Assimilation Aegis. That's going to try that. And there's another round, a big blinker. So, yeah, cool stuff, good stuff. Can't wait for Bloomborough is, of course, always the thing we say at the end of the Magic the Gathering section.
Yeah. Yeah, I liked it. I guess I played with most of the mechanics. I said I had a spree card, and sprees did feel very good. That flexibility is just so useful. But I don't think that's a surprise. I think everybody was able to immediately identify that spree cards are like just absurdly stupid good. I think mercenaries were interesting. I played very briefly with mercenaries, but the little I played, they were fine, like, you know, as a concept. I don't know if I'm gonna think too much on it. The outlaw batching never came up. I didn't have it in my games at all.
No, I had the Hotspur Hell Posse boss guy, which gave all my entire deck haste because every single one was a mercenary or assassin or rogue or whatever. Outlaws was my entire sealed thing, and it worked fine. I think it'll work better in Constructed when you can build around it more purposefully.
Yeah, and then Saddle was cool. I didn't get to do it a ton, but anytime I did, it got to feel pretty cool. And it was just also nice that's like, if I don't have another creature out, this still does something. Like, I could still attack with this Caustic Bronco even if there is nothing to saddle onto it or whatever. It was just sort of extra value. So, I don't know. It felt like the mechanics worked well. I still feel like the flavor in the set isn't 100% there. And I haven't gotten around to finishing the story for it either. My mind is already very firmly in the direction of Bloomborough.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a fun time. It was a fun pre-release. We got to open extra packs afterwards, prize packs. I don't think we got a ton. I guess the one thing we didn't talk about were big scorecards. So I think both of us opened at least 2 big scorecards in our sealed pools. These are the cards that are basically replacing the list. This was supposed to be like an extra set worth of cards, and then Aftermath was so reviled that they were like, put it in the main set. So it was sort of just an extra option. And I think of the 2 I got, one was the blue Simulacrum Factory thing or something like that. That honestly is not very good in draft, but it is like good in Constructed. I think it's like a $16 card for the worst version. So that's pretty cool. But then the other card I did open was Harvester of Misery, which is a 5-mana 5/4 with menace that when it enters the battlefield, all other creatures get -2/-2 until end of turn. And you can also pay 1 in black and discard it to give a creature -2/-2 until end of turn. And that card also put in quite a lot of work.
Yeah, Harvester of Misery is a take on Massacre Worm. I was saying that the big score, a lot of the themes were like classic cards, but a little bit fixed. And Simulacrum Synthesizer, the other one, is kind of a Karnstruct creator, Karn Strux being the constructs created by the classic Karn Planeswalker card. And that's going to be a deck in some formats. I've seen people popping off with Simulacrum Synthesizer, which is hard to say when you're dying. But
yeah,
seems good.
Good times. It was fun. Bloomborough should be sometime soon. I think before that, though, it's going to be Modern Horizons 3, which we may try to do a pre-release for as well. That might be a little bit more difficult to do because those formats are so much higher in power level. You have to usually remember a lot of mechanics that are like one-offs and things like that. So we shall see. But if we do it, we'll let you know.
We got to talk about the leaks. Come on, Grist. He's just a little guy.
Yeah. So Modern Horizons 3, one of the few things that were spoiled about it is flip walkers are returning. Back in the day, there was a set called Magic Origins, which had a mono planeswalker cycle of this. So each color got a planeswalker who we know is a planeswalker, but on their one side, they were a creature. The side you would play would be a creature side. And this was supposed to represent them before their spark erupted. And then there would be some kind of text in there that was supposed to be evocative of why they changed. And when that condition was fulfilled, you would flip them over to the other side, which was a planeswalker side. At the time, these cards were really, really good. Not all of them, but most of them were pretty good. The Jace saw some play. I think Liliana saw some play. And I can't remember. Nissa still sees like some commander play. So like those three were pretty good. The other two were fine. But they're going to do a cycle of them again. And I presume that it was going to be an enemy colored cycle because the two we had previewed were Ajani as a red white card. And then Tamiyo, who has commonly been a green blue card. So I was like, okay, that makes sense. Based on the other three enemy colored pairings, I was like, well, blue red will be will be Rao. Green-black will be Vraska, and then black-white will be Kaya, because those felt like three characters who are pretty significant to the story as of right now, and they haven't really had much time to focus on the story of any of those. Like, I don't actually know if Rao has story to him. I know he has relevant stuff now to himself, but if you asked me how Rao sparked, I'd be like, I have no idea.
I think he got struck by lightning while being gay.
Okay, well...
That sounds like I'm making fun of it. I think that's true.
What? How did the being gay factor into it?
Okay.
He's thinking about boys, and that's what sparked him. Like, what is?
I think so. Something like that.
Okay. I mean, you might be spoiling it. It does. I was 1 for 3 in the cards I predicted. Rao is the is it one, and it does seem to be something about he gets struck by lightning, and that's what caused him to ignite his spark and flip. And that card has had all of its tech spoiled. It's pretty good. It's a pretty solid card for Is It Spell Slinger. It seems like it could do a lot of work.
Reading from the Magic the Gathering fandom wiki, returning home wounded, Rao found Elias, his boyfriend, in the embrace of another man. The shock ignited his planeswalker's spark and he disappeared from Ravnica.
So his spark igniting was just that he was gay. It had nothing to do with lightning.
Unless someone edited this wiki to fuck with me, this is what it says.
All right, hold on. I almost have to go and try to find...
It's under youth, the section on the fandom wiki. He says he was hired by Nicol Bolas in 3 years working for Bolas's employ. His boyfriend Elias's career took off in a way neither of them had imagined. Blah, blah, blah. During one of his jobs, Rao was stabbed. Returning home wounded, he found Elias in the embrace of another man. The shock ignited his spark and he disappeared from Ravnica. Okay. So he got cheated on so hard he became magical.
Sure. I should note his card does not reference that in any way. His card is instant sorceries. You cast costs one less to cast. And then whenever you cast a sorcery during your turn, if you lose, Rao deals 1 damage to yourself. But if you win, you exile him and then get the planeswalker side of him. I don't know how walking in, finding out you're being cheated on is represented in the coin flip. I could have thought if you lost, then he deals 1 damage and flips might have been kind of relevant to it.
But every time you leave your partner alone, you're flipping a coin of getting cheated on. And if you fail to flip, you get owned. That's how it works. What does it say about the people in charge of the story that the first gay character is got cheated on gaily? What is it? What are they trying to say? What is this? My brain is too soupy to think about the implications.
I think the ultimate thing is that Raoul, I don't know if he has a ton of story. Like, he came out, what, during the Return to Ravnica set? He wasn't in the original Ravnica. So I don't know if they were still doing novels back then. So I don't know if there's a lot of, like, history there. This is just a character I feel like I've heard very little about. But at some point, Wizards said, like, oh, actually, we have, like, a, like, canonically queer-coded character who is in a color combo we don't normally get to play with a ton. So why don't we start pushing him to more of the spotlight? As we talked about in an in the Bloomborough set, he is the planeswalker of the set. So, like, the idea that Rao could have more of, like, a significant role in the story going forward is something I'm absolutely A-okay with. And hopefully, maybe, I mean, he's in a committed relationship now. That seems very happy. You know, good for him. I don't know about retroactively doing any of these things, but I do think that is funny that that's his. Everyone else is like, when I watched my father get executed on that stage, the rage ignited my spark, or I was being hunted by a grand beast, and before its jaws snapped shut on me, my spark ignited and I disappeared and all this stuff. He's just like, honey, I'm home. Oh, what the fuck? Poof.
Yeah, they made a bunch of characters who are kind of like checking the boxes of diversity and then never coming back to them. Another one, Nico Aris from Kaldheim, is like their first non-binary character. And gun to my head, could not tell you a thing about Nico Aris. I don't think they have appeared since their debut.
They were in that initial thing. They did not show up since then. I know they were from Theros, and I think they had a gimmick of, like, mirrors or something like that.
Yeah, they make enchantment shards.
Yeah. Probably desparked, I'll be honest. Like, there's so many planeswalkers they made that they were just like, despark them all. I'm like, okay, cool. Like, if we ever see Boss Riket again, they're probably going to be desparked.
Yeah. Of all the, flipwalkers that leaked, I don't remember the source of the leak. I just saw it linked onto Reddit. The one that's most interesting to me is Grist, who is literally a larva, like a little insect. And for a long time in Magic, it was like a rule that only sapient things could have sparks. That's why, like, for a long time, they dragged their feet on angels being able to be planeswalkers. They found a loophole eventually, but they're like, oh, technically angels are like concentrated white mana. They're not actually people. And, like, whatever, you know, we wanted it. And then they gave it to us eventually. And the same thing with this, where they're like, a bug can't really have a spark, but I guess if a bug has enough friends, it can. I don't know what's going on there. It's cool though. Grist rocks.
Yeah. I like Grist. There is also a Grist that is a planeswalker you can get that is also a creature anytime it's not on the battlefield. So it's like a weird ass card. Also Modern Horizons, I believe.
Yeah.
But we'll get a flipwalker version of it, which is fan service for a very select group of people. There are some people who are losing their minds over more Grist. I'm one of those people. I'm losing my mind over this. I'm sorry, Vraska. Bummed you don't get a card that gives you more showcase, but Grist, whew, I'm so excited. I can't wait to watch these bugs come together and kill people.
Yeah, there's all the art of Grist. We've only gotten the one card, but that has a couple of different art treatments. Are so wildly different that, yeah, my understanding of Grist is like more like a colony of different insects that can kind of take different shapes that incorporate like skulls and stuff. It's very metal. It's cool. Like every picture of Grist looks like a black metal album cover.
There was a previous version of the season 11 story where I had a collective colony of bugs that was sentient that I would have used so much Grist art for.
We haven't even mentioned much. I guess we're going to transition out of this topic, but season 11 Dice Funk still going on. I still have my files backed up. I assume that was taken for granted, but in case you're worried, I do have all the recordings in a drive somewhere, so I didn't lose them. The last episode you heard was the one where Allison and Barbella had their cool duel, and then there was the showdown at the church where Reaper kind of big dog the priest, and then they went to the farm where they met Lucius the blue dragon. That was a pretty cool encounter. That's an important character. And then yeah, so I'm leaving you off in that cliffhanger. I'm going to end this episode we're recording with a tease about what is going to be uploaded on Sunday, because it's not the new Dice Funk because of my computer exploding and dying, but then we'll be back at it again. It should be the week after that with your regularly scheduled Dice Funk. So
yeah,
Wet Team will return.
Yep, there's going to be some really, really cool stuff coming forward. I'm very excited. Lots of things are like expanding as we're recording this season, and there's some really, really cool ideas, I think, going forward. So looking forward to it.
Yep. We saw some movies. I know we're not going to have time to hit all of them before we crash out, but we're going to hit the big ones. Which ones do you want to talk about specifically?
Well, I think if we're doing this episode, we want to knock out the two biggest ones, which would be we saw Civil War, and then maybe not as big. This movie is like almost a month old by the time we're talking about it, but we did see Godzilla, King Kong, A New Empire, I think it's called.
The New Empire. Is that a month old? I thought that was only like 2 weeks at max.
I think it was a week old when you first showed up. And then it's been about, yeah, so it's like, I think about 3 weeks old at this point.
Wow. Yeah, let's talk about Kong.
Because
it's very much a piece with the last one, Godzilla versus Kong, in which I think objectively pretty stupid PS4 commercial or PS4 cutscene. But like, we both had a pretty good time, I think. I think we laughed and we cheered.
Yeah, I mean, so these like King Kong, Godzilla, Monsterverse movies, I forget what the name for like the established universe is. Titanverse? I don't know what the fuck it's called.
It's the Monsterverse.
Is it the Monsterverse? It feels like you shouldn't be allowed to do that. The Universal Monsters also were trying to get a universe, but that was called something different, but whatever.
The Dark Universe?
Yeah. So, the Monsterverse movies have always had like a bit of a critique to them, which is like, yeah, it's really cool to watch like monsters beat the shit out of each other, but there's all these boring humans that make it difficult to care about like the hour and a half in between all those cutscenes that they're talking about. And this movie doesn't quite fix the problem, but it does reduce the cast down pretty small and then gives each one of those characters kind of like a bit more personality to work with. Like there's less room for all of it. Like once they start turning those characters also into cartoon characters, it functions a little bit better. It's not perfect. I still couldn't tell you really any of their names at the end of this, or
podcast.
No, podcast is the name of the kid from Ghostbusters. This is a guy who podcasts. It's different.
No, every big budget action comedy now has a character named Podcast. Okay. And podcasts, because that's the joke. It's funny to podcast.
It is pretty funny to podcast when you think about it. So I will say that it wasn't horrendous. They were tolerable. But yeah, then you got the action set piece scenes where Kong goes around and punches another monkey. For some reason, the evil monkey has a lot of swag to him. Like he's got a lot of charisma. I was like, damn.
He's a Bishonen anime villain. He's like posing on his throne. He's like trying to get you to do like a fan cam. I when I saw the trailer for this movie,
were you gooning for the evil monkey?
I was not gooning, no. When I saw the trailer for this movie, I thought the evil red monkey was like a fake out, because I was like, well, one monkey can't beat Kong and Godzilla, obviously. So that's like the first act villain. And when he's defeated, they'll reveal the real villain. Like how in King Kong versus Godzilla, it was actually Mecha Godzilla was the real antagonist. Yeah. After they punch themselves out a little bit. But no, Red Monkey is the villain. Like there are supporting kaiju, but he is the final boss. And it's surprising how well he holds his own, considering how completely outmatched you'd think he would be. But his just pure charisma and some of the circumstances around what's happening. Because the premise of this movie is like, okay, so we found a hollow Earth inside of our Earth. It's only 5% explored. So surely we'll find new dangers in the hollow Earth in the 95% we haven't explored. Oops, no, we found a deeper, other hollow Earth inside this one.
It's a second deeper Earth inside of that.
Why? For world build, I mean, just who cares, right? It's just supposed to be funny, I guess. For world building purposes, it's very silly. But in that one, there is like a secret eviler monkey who's just, I don't know what his motivation is besides he loves evil. He just is cruel and wants to destroy everything. It's never expanded upon. He doesn't have any dialogue, obviously. You just kind of take from his body language and deeds that he's just a devilish monkey. But then, yeah, the King Kong is the main character. This is a King Kong movie where Godzilla shows up at the end after level grinding the whole thing, which isn't really a criticism. I just think it's interesting that Godzilla for most of the movie is just off doing something else. And then he kind of shows up for the final battle. But yeah, King Kong goes on a journey of like self-discovery because he's lonely. He thinks he's the only monkey. He finds other monkeys. The monkeys are mean. It's like a whole emotional journey for Kong.
Yeah.
But yeah, the actual action fights, you know, when King Kong, I saw this GIF before I saw the movie, but uses one monkey to beat other monkeys, like with monkey nunchucks. It was just really funny and good. There's some pretty, fun moments of creature carnage. One part I found kind of disappointing was they treat a lot of the other kaiju as really disposable. Like they kill sea serpents in back-to-back unrelated scenes off screen. I was like, damn, you didn't respect either of those guys at all.
Yeah, if you were a sea serpent fan, I would strongly urge you to not watch this movie because it's gonna be painful to watch.
Yeah, they just don't respect your game at all. Yeah. But yeah, the actual fighting stuff, it really feels like something I would have been into when I was like 13. In my review, I mentioned like the first time I saw the opening cutscene for Final Fantasy VIII, where everyone's fighting with gun blades, and I was like, this is the sickest thing ever. It's very that. And the humans aren't too annoying or whatever. They're fine. They mostly look up at things happening just off screen and go like, wow.
Yeah. There was something that annoyed me at the end. Is one of the character comments like, we're going to be treated like heroes. And I'm like, why? What did you guys do? You didn't really assist in much of anything when it comes down to it. I guess one of you brought that King Kong glove that he needs to wear. But like, it's not like you guys stopped the evil monkey in any way. Like, fuck you. You don't get credit for this.
Yeah, the glove was so perfunctory because it's in all the trailers, so it wasn't a surprise. And the way it's deployed, just like, Kong hurt his hand, give him a glove. All right, glove get.
Yeah.
And then he moves on.
I kept thinking the glove would do something more interesting, like, oh, you know, because, you know, Kong is just a brawler. He doesn't have, like, atomic breath like Godzilla or anything like that. So this is going to be, like, a way to give him, like, you know, some science to match up with this. I think you used the comparison, like, King Kong is becoming Batman, and, like, this is, like, I don't know, like, give Batman, like, a special laser gun or something. Like, it's going to do something cool. And then it is just a glove.
Yeah. It's fine, though. I gave it 3. It's a perfectly serviceable, action, comedy, punch him up. It's fine.
Yeah.
It's good.
I enjoyed myself well enough.
And then I saw two movies that used AI. And I got to say right up top, that's an instant 1-star for me. That's just a policy I'm going to have. Because if you don't respect other artists enough not to steal from them, I'm not going to respect your movie enough to engage with it critically. So just before we even talk about the actual merits of Civil War and Late Night with the Devil, 1-star for both of those for me. Sorry about that, I guess.
No, I think you're very much right in the right to do so. Oh boy, it's going to be tough to talk about this because Civil War is, I think, one of the more divisive movies that I've seen this year. Like, it feels like there are a lot of differing opinions on this, and a lot of people feel very strongly the way they do on the movie. And we even had a divisive movie theater experience at our showtime for this.
I cannot believe it. Yeah, this movie will never, for me, be extricable from how we saw it, which is with the most disruptive man in film-going history. So you and I were in – this is a huge theater. It's the biggest theater room inside this complex, right? I don't know, 1,000 seats.
This is the theater that new releases get showed at. So if you want to have like a Marvel opening night theater experience, this is the showtime. This is the theater you try to get, 7 or 8, because that's the huge those are the huge theaters.
So we're in this fucking cavernous room, you and me in the very back.
Yes,
there's like only one or two other people like very far away. No big deal. And right before the movie starts, someone comes in. I think they, tell me if I'm wrong. I think they smelled like weed, first of all.
I never got to smell them. There's a couple factors that are like that. We are seated in the middle in the very back row. Usually the way I prefer to do it is sit in the corner, but there was someone in the corner seat in the back row. So I was like, all right, let's do the middle. Like, this theater's huge. There's empty seats everywhere. This guy comes all the way down the row to us before. And like, I think like, oh, did he get a seat on the other side and decided to like walk through back here or whatever? But no, he sits down like two seats away from us, which is very weird.
It's like a urinal meme.
Yes.
It's like if you're at the far urinal and there's like five open ones and they stand next to you for some reason. I mean, I don't want to be like antisocial. Like, I do enjoy my fellow man from time to time.
No, it's like weird. It's fucking, it's like 1:30 in the afternoon on a Wednesday. Like, go away, dude. What are you doing?
What was the shirt reading? He's wearing, maybe it was a sweater.
His sweater just said slut magic on it. started to get concerned. This is one of the few times, like, I am still in a many different stages in my transition, and one of the few things I haven't really done is like go out wearing like aggressively feminine clothing. But this is one of the few times I was like, I'm gonna go out wearing a dress. So there was like a moment I was like, oh god, is this just someone coming up to like our situation like this? Like, I there was like a lot of weird thoughts running through my head, and then when I saw the slut match t-shirt, I was like, does this make me feel better or worse about this circumstance?
Yeah, my read on the guy is he would have been cool with you if he had really like zeroed in on your situation. Maybe too cool, like maybe weird about it, but in a like a too positive way. But he just wasn't that focused on us. He was very much in his own world.
So we came to see Civil War. This guy came to see Civil War. Like, he was in it for this.
He was a big fan of the concept of war, I think.
This was his Avengers Endgame. Like, I don't know what this guy's movie tastes are, but this hit his Letterbox top four after this. If he has one, I guarantee it.
Yeah, I'm gonna search Letterboxd for like slut magic, see if I can find this guy. So besides the fact that he sat near us, eventually he whispered to me something like, don't tell the management I'm not sitting in my assigned seat, and then he like ran away to a different seat.
He moved like a couple rows forward because we were right basically underneath the projectionist booth, and he moved like a couple rows forward in that sort of line. So he would be also kind of underneath the projectionist booth. He would get, I guess, what many people would consider like the prime movie going seats or whatever.
Which, I mean, he didn't really need to get me involved. But once again, I don't want to act like it's off limits to talk to a human being in public. It's fine.
I wasn't going to be like, officers, moving seats.
Yeah, it was a little like, I get, maybe he was just being playful. That to me, not yet.
Because hold
weird.
On.
Okay.
He did that. He asked you like, hey, don't tell on me about not switching seats. And he sits in his seats, and then I didn't hear the full breadth of that conversation. I like kind of cleared it up with you afterwards. But after he sat down, like 2 or 3 minutes passed, he turned around and looked at the two of us and gave like a coy wink, like, I'm like, why are you making this weird, my guy?
I think that's because that's when the acid hit, honestly. If I had to guess, I think that's what happened.
This man had something. There is something going on. Some chemical concoction was expanding inside of his body at this movie.
Yeah, so we haven't even got to the opening yet. So the movie starts, and he just yells full voice, as top of his lungs, can't wait for this to happen in real life.
I think he said something like, it's happening, everybody! Like, as though we were all on bated breath for Civil War to begin. Like, finally, our long wait is over.
Oh, that's how you took it? I thought he was just saying, like, oh, you know, this is how it's going to be. Like, this is a grim portent of the near future.
Maybe I took it as this guy was very excited because of the next thing he did to interrupt the movie, which was like, so this movie's like fairly quiet throughout portions of it, and like, we're not alone in this theater. There's probably like maybe 20 people scattered throughout this huge theater, and like, two people quietly whispered somewhere else in the theater. Not enough that I heard what they were saying or anything like that, but enough that it was somewhat audible. And the second they started whispering, this guy just shouts out, "Quiet in the theater, please!" Like, nothing could disturb this experience for him.
Which is wild, because he's way more disruptive. I didn't hear the other people at all.
No, I barely heard them, but very audibly heard him saying, "Everybody shut up, please!"
So, yeah, Civil War is basically a road trip movie. It's not so much about the actual politics of the second American Civil War. The factions are only kind of obliquely referenced. It's not the point. It's basically a short story collection where four journalists, you know, go from place to place in a car and then, like, get out to have a vignette and then get back in the car to go to the next vignette. It's fine, and we'll talk about that. But, yeah, it's, like, long periods of silence punctuated by, like, hellishly loud gunfire as shit gets real. And every time there is a terrible war crime, which is basically every 20 minutes, because that's the kind of premise of the movie, is journalists documenting the depravity of, you know, man, brother versus brother. He burst into applause.
Yeah.
At first I thought maybe he was like pro one of the sides, you know, where he was like, yeah, tell that racist, fascist, you know, fucking bullshit troops, get their asses. But no, it was any time someone just like killed an unarmed civilian, which was pretty constant, he would just burst into applause. And I my takeaway was just, he's a big fan of war crimes.
I don't know if it's that. So my reading of this is, he clapped, I think, twice during this movie. The first time was after like a big action set piece where it was very clear there was a period of catharsis for the audience afterwards. Like, there was a break in what you were meant to pay attention to. So there was a moment of solace, and he started applauding as though, again, this were like a Marvel movie and Captain America just picked up Mjolnir. Like, he's like, yes, guys, what did we all just witness together? And it's like, I don't know, dude. Like, I'm kind of still trying to process what I watched a little bit. There's complicated thoughts. This is a movie about war. I don't know if it's as clean cut and simple, but he was just very excited. He was like, perfect execution all the way through, brother. You're probably more right. Maybe he is just a freak, but I was going in the way that he was just very into this movie.
My memory is there are three times he burst into applause, extended applause, oh. not a little bit.
I may have forgotten one. Maybe I blocked one out from secondhand cringe, because this is one of those times where I was like, I am actively embarrassed to be in this theater.
And each time was specifically when an unarmed surrendering person was riddled with bullets. Yeah. There was the end of that long sequence where they're clearing that apartment building, and then they take like two people into like the middle distance and like line them up and shoot them.
Yes.
There's the end that I don't want to spoil, where an unarmed person gets riddled with bullets, and then there was, I think, a third time in between there. But it's the common thread seemed to me to be killing people who couldn't fight back. And maybe I'm just reading it. Maybe that's just because that happened so often in the movie. It seemed like that. Wowzers Bowsers. That's how I'm going to remember this movie for sure.
It is worth noting the way the movie ends is with this very shocking sort of moment. And as it happens, he begins loudly applauding, which then leads into the credits, leading into his standing ovation for this movie. As I feel like every other person in the theater tried to awkwardly shuffle away, lest they get like caught with him in an alleyway and he starts asking them their thoughts of the movie or something. Like, I had to watch you, because you do not do well with cringe. I had to watch you like bury yourself in your shirt as his loud clapping just kept going.
Oh, it was unpleasant. I mean, hearing us tell the story now, I'm like, maybe we're just the fun police. Maybe this is a guy who saw a movie he liked and he clapped.
It's fine. It is disruptive and weird. There are times where I think you are allowed to be like rambunctious and like wild in a theater, and like that's not the time. It's not on a Wednesday at like 1:30 or whatever. It's Civil War with 20 people in the theater. You're weird if you do that. I don't care. Like, I know there's like some people who are like, you should never clap at the end of the movie. That's cringe. I'm like, I don't know if I necessarily would do it, but I get why people do it. But clapping in the middle of the movie for a thing that is not like I don't know. Like, I guess there's maybe something you could do. Like, maybe there's, like, a Nazi and a dog bites his balls off and you'd start applauding that. But this wasn't that. This was, like, as you said, this is unarmed people getting mowed down. And you're like, I think it's weird to make so much of a presence in all of this.
Yeah, so we haven't talked about Civil War the movie much, but I don't know that there's anything new to say because it's been such a hot topic in like film circles.
Oh, I have a lot to say, I feel like. I have a lot of thoughts to still work through.
Oh, interesting. I'll say it seems a pretty clear-cut movie. It's like the power of journalism, you know, the bravery of journalists. It's not really about the politics of America. They go out of their way to not make it a red state versus blue state, lib versus Republican thing. All the people, all the, you know, combatants are like almost interchangeable. You often don't know who's who, and that's fine because it doesn't matter. The important thing is that these journalists are risking it all to document the truth at great personal cost. It's filmed pretty well. I like Alex Garland a lot. I liked Annihilation and Ex Machina a lot. Men less so, I will say. But this seems like a pretty, you know, obvious movie. I don't even mean that in like a negative way. It seems to be setting out to do something pretty predictable, and it mostly accomplishes that. And it making everyone mad, I guess, is kind of predictable because it maybe is kind of a inflammatory title for a movie and everyone's on edge right now, but seeing some of the responses, truly unhinged people either saying it's not political at all or reading just the strangest politics into it. And that's just like, it's not my problem that everyone else's brains are melted.
Sure. So I will say, I have heard a lot of people complain that they're like, this movie's too apolitical, which is like a coward's thing. And, you know, we talked a bit when we discussed, Election Day or Founders Day, I think it was.
Founders Day.
Which was, like, embarrassingly apolitical. Like, it tried, like, it created two new identities for political parties that don't exist to avoid having to do that. I don't think this movie necessarily avoids being political. It just doesn't dig into it anyway. I think it was kind of obvious who, like, the cabinet is supposed to represent. Like, I don't think it's supposed to be, like, a hidden detail that you're, like, meant to figure out. Like, I think it's kind of clear, like, what group of political people were running the country at that point in time based off of some of the actions they've done, which real-life people of that political party also have tried to do. So, you know, I don't know if I necessarily agree with the idea it's apolitical because it's focused on the journalists. But I would say that I think it's a very pessimistic and kind of empty analysis of journalism, war journalism in my mind, because I thought it was supposed to be a movie about how war journalism is important and harrowing. But I feel like the way it ended kind of was like saying, hey, aren't war journalists actually kind of psychopaths when you think about it? Like, aren't they kind of fucked up little weirdos who don't really have a shred of humanity anymore because they've had to bury it all to survive all the trauma they've been through? Because like the end of the movie, it's not, they haven't changed anything. Like the end of the movie is bleakly about how they failed to change anything, but they are still chasing this story at the cost of like their own humanity. Like it is actively damaging them and the people around them to continue going after this. And what they are getting is worthless. They are not chasing journalism. There is no like impartialness. They just need some kind of like end result, some catharsis to justify all of the daredevil hunting they've been kind of doing. And I thought that, like, as I thought on it more, I was like, I guess I just don't find that very interesting. Like, I do like explorations into, oh, isn't this profession kind of fucked up and weird when you think about it? That's one of my favorite parts of Barry, you know, the idea of like, is it acting kind of fucked up a little bit if you think about it in a certain way? Like, aren't some actors kind of freaks when you think about it? And, you know, Nightcrawler's away, like, aren't these people just trying to get news kind of fucked up weirdos? I don't think this movie spends that much time analyzing how difficult this is. There's a couple little set pieces, but by the end, like, I think you are supposed to come away with the idea of like, yeah, war journalism is really, really important, and how like harrowing it is and how difficult it is to remain neutral when you're just watching like, you know, crimes against humanity get inflicted all around you. But the end of the movie like shows it in such a a bleak way that I was like, I don't think you could say, like, you can come away with like, oh wow, how important this is at the end, when you're like, actually those people were really bad and kind of weirdos when you think about it.
I mean, it's hard to talk about the movie's themes without the ending, which is, I don't really think we should do spoilers, but there is a line in the trailer, which is in the movie, but just so that people would have seen it, where Kirsten Dunst says, when I was covering wars overseas, I thought I was sending a message home, please don't do this, and yet here it is happening. Which is, yeah, speaking to the futility of their endeavor. Like, what is the point of war journalism if not to dissuade people from doing war? And it doesn't work. So if you're making a pro-journalism movie with the message that journalism doesn't work, I guess it can feel unsatisfying. I, like you said, I'm glad you brought up Nightcrawler, which feels like a companion piece, where it's about crime journalism, which it's not that no one should report on crime. It's not like that's a futile endeavor necessarily, but the way it's done under capitalism is so exploitative as to be actively harmful.
Yeah.
And I think that's a similar message here. It's just like, you know, journalism is maybe a noble idea, but the way it's practiced is essentially exploitative. And I don't know if maybe I miscommunicated or if you were speaking to a different point, but obviously the movie is political. I think it would be completely brain dead. A movie about a civil war. journalism isn't political.
I'm not saying that to your point. That is to larger points that I've heard levied against. Because this is like an extremely divisive movie. Like, I feel like it's getting reviews from kind of all over the place. And some of the complaints I've heard is that it is too apolitical. Like, it doesn't talk about these things in enough detail.
Yeah, I think that's because people are like, oh, it doesn't talk about cancel culture or, you know, like gender. Yeah. So it's not political. It's like, that's just not what politics means. I'm sorry that you just started paying attention to the news a couple years ago, but like, there are much bigger things in the world. But yeah, the movie resists your attempts to map onto it what you bring, like your neuroses. I think if the movie was you know, libs versus conservatives or whatever, you would just go in wanting to root for your team. And then when your team does war crimes, you would be upset, you know? And that's just not what it is. That's why they make the kind of California and Texas teamed up, which is like not, it's not conceivable to the average political analyst. That doesn't seem to make sense. Of course, if they're both seceding from the same government who would declare war on secessionists, they have a common enemy, and actually does make that much sense as a political alliance of convenience for the moment, but whatever, not the point. The point is that you don't just go in rooting for a team to win because you like their politics. Everyone is doing war crimes. Everyone's uniforms are essentially identical. You know, there's many, like the best scenes are when you literally don't know who person represents. Like the scene everyone's going to talk about for years to come, it's in all the trailers, is Jesse Plemons playing the most dead-eyed psycho, and you never know what his politics are. Except that he's racist.
Yeah, I was going to say, you know that he's racist, and pretty flagrantly so.
Yeah, but not between the sides, you know? I guess you could say, oh, that's the loyalists, because they're implied to be the party of Ronald Trump, played by Nick Offerman. Fair enough. But, like, what's terrifying about that scene is that, like, a person with a gun and no accountability is just completely unpredictable, and they can do whatever they want, you know?
That's when the movie is at its most effective, is as they're wandering the country, stumbling into sort of these different situations. That's, like, a great scene that has just a ton of tension to it. There's another scene where there's characters, and it's very specifically, it's almost kind of like a joke to think about, but they ask, like, what side are you on? And the person's like, I don't even know, but I have to kill this person.
Yeah. So, that's one of my favorite. I think that might be my favorite scene, is someone says, who are you? Who are you shooting at? Who's giving you orders? And the guy says, no one's giving us orders. They're shooting at us, so we're shooting at them.
Yeah.
Which is,
There are definitely, like, some very unnerving scenes. And that's one thing that has been talked about this movie a lot, that it's very anxiety-inducing. You, Stone Cold, were like, no, didn't scare me at all. Everyone's babies but me. I did feel the tension at certain scenes, because, as mentioned, this is a movie that is very quiet at certain points in time, and the silence is very frequently broken through by the sound of gunfire. So if you're somebody who is not used to the sound of gunfire, I think I've heard a gunshot outside of like a firing range like maybe I could count it on like one hand in my lifetime. Like, it's not a sound I hear a whole lot out in the suburbs. So like when it does happen, it is shocking. It is like, you know, like you could feel your heartbeat kind of go up and whatnot. But I think that also lulled me into thinking this was a good movie throughout most of it. Like, I spent so much time being like, wow, it's really getting this reaction out of me. And I don't know how I feel about it in the long run, because I don't think about that part of the movie as much as I think about the ending now.
Yeah. It really feels like they spend a lot of the movie kind of just wasting time. And that's not even accurate. That's unfair. But like I said before, it's like a collection of short stories. Like, they go from one vignette to the other with the cars, yeah, the loading screen. I saw someone actually refer to it like as video game inspired, where it's like there's a bunch of different levels, which they said it negatively. I don't think it has to be negative. It can, you know, that's a storytelling form.
I love the movie 1917, and that is essentially a video game where, like, there are, like, distinct levels in that movie. Like, there are transitions where you're like, ah, I'm in this stage now. I'm in the river stage or whatever. And I love that movie. I think it's one of the, you know, one of the more beautiful movies I've ever seen.
Yeah, but those two movies are actually pretty similar. They're both war movies where they have all these different kind of disconnected vignettes, and it's only, like, at the end of the second act or something. Whereabouts, where there's an event where everything changes and now the plot has starting to happen. It becomes a more normal linear movie. I don't necessarily want to spoil either one, but like there's a very distinct like, oh, we're in the end game now in both 1917 and Civil War. And I think some people would want the movies to be more of that the whole time than the episodic stuff. Although, like, one of the early episodes in Civil War is they come across a gas station where some people have hung up looters. And it kind of reminds me of The Act of Killing, a documentary about some people, yeah, who participated in the genocide and how casual they are. They're like, yeah, that we tortured them for days. It's normal. Like, just the strange callousness of it, I thought, was pretty good. It's also, that movie is referenced at the end of The Zone of Interest. Both those movies end the same way. So I've been thinking about that a lot. So, like, I think the performances are pretty good. I don't know how you felt about, like, the lead characters. They're, like, pretty thinly characterized, but there's this weird element where, so there's an older male and an older female journalist, like the main duo, and then they kind of adopt a younger female journalist, but there's also this weird tension, like the guy kind of flirts with the younger journalist, but she doesn't flirt back, but she does flirt with Kirsten Dunst. Did you pick up on this?
So, I picked up on parts of it, except the part where she flirts with Kirsten Dunst. There's a bit of like a, you're my hero, I want to capture the side of you that can't be seen reading through your Wikipedia page. It's like a line straight from the movie where she's just like, I read your Wikipedia page. I want to know about the stuff that doesn't make it on there. She like wants to like find the connections to this person she hasn't been able to kind of understand otherwise. And I thought that was interesting to like a small extent. It felt like it didn't have as much of a significance at the end. There's like, again, I don't want to spoil this movie, but like there's a picture that gets taken at one point in this movie that I thought like 100% that's going to show up at some point in this movie, and it just never does. Or maybe it's like a post credit thing and we didn't stay for that because we had a weird dude in a Slut Magic t-shirt very loudly. But the fact that like the guy hit on her was something that I like only heard in like one quick line that I was like, oh, wait, is that supposed to be like a part of this relationship that's going on? Because that's a character, the guy, who as the movie goes on, you realized how kind of deranged he is. Like, that's like a character who as the movie continues, like, oh, this dude's kind of like a little fucked up. Oh, this dude's really fucked up now that I think about it, actually. And I just don't think it's as interesting. Like, I don't know. I feel like there's a lot of different ways to do it. And then I realize all these other ways are just better movies that you could watch instead. Like, if you want to watch, like, sickos go freak mode, like, go watch Nightcrawler. Like, it's, like, a harrowing movie. But, like, I think it's, like, more of an interesting experience. There are better, like, road trip movies. I think there are better movies about, like, the importance of journalism. Oh gosh, I forget the actor's name, but the actor who plays Sammy, I was so excited because I really do like that actor, Stephen McKinley Henderson. They give him nothing to do. Like, if you've seen the trailer, you've seen everything this character does in this movie, which was really disappointing.
Yeah, he's playing the wise older black man that he often plays. Also RIP to his Dune character who was cut out of Dune 2. Sucks.
Yeah. I think it was really disappointing how narrow that character was.
But all the characters are really flat, which is why I kind of bring up the love triangle thing, because I felt like it was something that was added like in a later script pass where they're like, none of these characters have much going on internally. They're all kind of shells of traumatized people, which is fine. But like, they're like, let's add a little flavor. Let's add a little funk to this. What if there's a kind of unspoken love triangle, and then it doesn't really develop, or it doesn't like climax, there's no resolution, which is fine. It is not, you know, that no one has to hook up. I just found it like a very like a human touch on an otherwise like inhuman movie, where there's specifically I'm referencing where the younger journalist buys Kirsten Dunst a dress and tells her like, oh, you look so pretty when you smile, and she tries to like get her to take candid pictures in a way that's like, I mean it just is flirting. I don't know what to tell you.
I mean, I think you can definitely read it that way. I guess I didn't, because that scene didn't do enough. Like, in my mind, I thought it was more about, like, Kirsten Dunst, who doesn't wear dresses because she spends most of her time as a military war journalist. You're never going to do that. So, like, she sees herself kind of removed of all the other stuff. She sees herself more in, like, I guess what we consider, quote-unquote, a normal state or whatever. And she like has a bit of a reaction to it and gets like a candid picture taken of her. And then I was like, oh, okay. Like, cause the idea is like these characters are supposed to be human. I think you can definitely read flirt into it. I hadn't considered it before, but it's such like, it doesn't go anywhere or do anything. Like, there's no follow up from that or anything that I just don't know how to like I could be like, sure. But it feels like one of those things, like, in another movie, you're like, oh, what if fucking Stilgar started flirting with Paul Atreides' mom for one random scene and stopped? You'd be like, well, that was kind of weird. Was it like, wouldn't you have cut that out of the movie?
Yeah, I don't know if it's necessarily good or bad. I just thought it was an interesting little touch there. Because most of the rest of the movie, yeah, pretty straightforward road trip. You go to one scene, oh God, look at all this terrible stuff. Next scene, look at all this terrible stuff. Next scene, look at all this terrible stuff.
Yeah.
Beautifully shot, but not particularly interesting. And like I said up top, they used AI for the movie posters. Just embarrassing, shameful. If you don't care about your movie, why should I fuck you? So...
I agreed with you in that I gave it 1 star. I think if I were like to be asked on a whole, removing the AI, what would it be? I think it would be like a 3 star.
Yeah.
But excuse me. But I think if you were to ask me, like, removed the AI and everything from it, I'd say it'd be like a 3 star. But as is, yeah, it's gonna be a 1 star. I think it's pretty shitty to do that as part of the marketing for this movie. I don't know. Maybe Alex Garland isn't a bright person. I don't know what to say. Maybe they're skilled at directing, but maybe they're just not very smart at realizing, like, oh, our country has a lot of problems. AI isn't one of them, though.
It's funny you say that, because Alex Garland has said in the wake of this movie's release that he's retiring from directing.
He came back and reneged on that immediately.
Okay. Well, it seems like he always only wanted to be a writer. You know, he got to start writing 28 Days Later. He seems to be a talented writer. I doubt he had anything to do with the AI. To be clear, I'm sure that was like a marketing firm hired by the studio. None of the – Kirsten Dunst personally didn't go to the Dolly art generator or whatever and type that in. It's not like her fault. It's not any of the creative people's fault.
I don't know 100% about that.
Okay.
Because while I would say that, yes, there is a marketing team, and it's disappointing that A24 had any kind of acknowledgement of this or anything like that. As the director, like, maybe these things were made retroactively without his choice, but I think that's when you have to have a responsibility to come out and say, like, I absolutely denounce and... condemn the use of AI in this marketing material. And I don't believe there is any sort of quote or anything like that. So, I mean, if you're the director, you represent this project as a whole, including its promotional material. A lot of times you have a hand in it.
Yeah, I mean, I understand in Hollywood, you don't want to step on too many toes. You don't want to slam people's dicks in the door because you might need them later.
If you're retiring from movies, why not? Who cares? What do you care at that point?
Yeah, fair enough.
If I was retiring from the movie business, I would shit on so many people on my way out the door.
I mean, I like this movie more than Men, but not as much as Ex Machina and Annihilation. That's where it lands for me. But it's more important than any individual movie is the goal that we do not let AI usage be normalized or acceptable. We have to be weird and aggressive about this. They need to be scared of us. That's how I feel about it.
Yeah, supremely, supremely fucked up. Need to stop doing it, and not acceptable. A24, get better.
And that's why I will talk about our last movie real quick that I know you didn't see, and that is Late Night with the Devil, a horror movie that I was really excited about when I first saw a trailer for it. It is starring David Dasmalchian, who we love seeing in all kinds of things. He is the Mentat Peter DeVries in the first Dune movie. He is one of the little freaks in Oppenheimer. Yeah, one of the little scientist guys. He's always around. He's being a silly little guy we love to see. I think he was the polka dot man in Suicide Squad. We love him. And so I was so excited for him to star in a big horror movie. Unfortunately, it does have AI interstitials, just basic artwork that you could commission from any of the nice people on Twitter for like $100 if you needed to. Just really fucking sucks. The movie itself, honestly, even AI aside, was pretty disappointing. The premise is that this is a found footage movie. It's like a recording from the 70s of a late night talk show guy who has a supernatural thing that happened to him. Like, what if Carson was, beset by devilry? And they don't commit to the bit. Like, while it is like, oh, here's the 70s footage, it'll then cut to other camera angles so people can have shot, reverse shot conversations like a normal movie. And I think that's, I don't want to use the word lazy, but like either do the thing or don't do the thing, you know? It's like figure out a way to make the restrictions work for your premise, your conceit. If you're just going to make a normal movie in there, then you didn't really make the movie you set out to. I don't know. Maybe that's nitpicky, but that bothered me. And then the actual haunting stuff is just, it's the fucking goddamn Exorcist again. It's a little girl who talks in a spooky voice. It's the same thing as we just watched The Exorcist Believer, which I fucking hated because all they did was have two little girls who talk in a spooky voice. And watching this again made me hate The Exorcist Believer even more, because at least in the final act of Late Night with the Devil, there is an escalation. Like the last like 15 minutes are pretty cool. But all the lead up to that stuff is just The Exorcist again. I'm so fucking sick of little girls who say spooky stuff that they cuss and talk about sex in a deeper voice. It's been 60 years, you fucking cretins. Please, one other spooky thing. You have to be able to think of another spooky thing. It sucks.
They're like, what if a little girl talked creepy though with like a deep voice? Maybe she twists her head around or does like dangerous things to her own body.
Yeah, all that stuff happens. It's the same stuff. I was literally thinking about, there's a anthology series called VHS. They've made like 8 of these, but they're like, each of them is like a series of found footage horror shorts where people like find a box of VHS tapes and play them. And there's like usually 4 or 5 shorts in a VHS movie. And I've only seen the first one, which I didn't like, but each of them, each of the shorts in the VHS film have the same twist, which is that the little girl is evil. It's the only thing that horror writers can think of, and it's gone past annoyance to like, I'm actively like pissed about this at this point.
On that point, have you seen the trailer for The Trap?
I saw people talking about the new M. Night Shyamalan movie, The Trap, but I have not watched the trailer, no.
Okay. So there is a trailer for it that it's like a dad brings his little girl to see. I think the performer is like called like Night Raven or something like that. And he goes at some point to like go to the bathroom, and he sees a bunch of cop cars around the building. And he asks somebody like, hey, what's up? And the guy's like, yeah, the serial killer, the butcher is here. And they set a trap for him. They're going to definitely find this guy. And I forget the lead actor. He was in one of the Godzilla movies, but he like goes to the bathroom and we see him pull up a phone. He has someone tied up in the basement and everyone's like, oh, but I've heard a bunch of people are like, the twist is going to be the little girl is actually the one doing it, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's an M. Night Shyamalan movie, so it has to have a twist, right? And that's a pretty good one. I heard people talking about this, that the pop star at the concert is M. Night Shyamalan's daughter. So he basically made a whole movie and to let his daughter have a cool role, which is fun.
Hell yeah, go for it. I don't care.
But it would be fun if either the pop star or his daughter were the real serial killer. I'm trying to remember the last... Oh, yeah, I saw A Knock at the Cabin, which was an adaptation. So it didn't really have that much M. Night stank on it because he just did the existing book. I think Old was also a book. Or no, it was a graphic novel. So he's been doing a lot of adaptations recently. I don't know why I'm talking about M. Night Shyamalan.
Because you love him. You're such a huge fan.
I really like some of his stuff.
You lived in Philadelphia. That's as close as you can get to being M. Night Shyamalan.
That is the closest you can get. I guess Late Night with the Devil, I will say I really liked the last 15 minutes of it, and I liked the idea of it, although it didn't deliver, and I think the AI sucks. I was disappointed. I really thought it was going to be really cool, and it was just like disappointing and then okay. So that's a bummer for me. As we leave, because I thought we were going to keep this short, we should probably talk about the Fallout Amazon series because it's in the news. Everyone's talking about it. It's the hot thing. I think it makes sense for us to talk about it for podcasting purposes.
Yeah. So if we're going to talk about that now, I'll try to keep it relatively quick because you don't want to have to edit too much, especially 420 coming up. Blaze it, everybody. We'll talk about that in another episode, I feel like. The Fallout series came out. I am a big fan of Fallout, though. You would call me a New Age fan, I guess. I never played the original two games. I briefly played, I think, Fallout 1 for a 24-hour stream I did once. And I mostly just fucked around in it. I didn't like really play the game per se. I couldn't really figure it out, to be honest. But I love Fallout 3. I love Fallout 4. I played a ton of Fallout 76. And I enjoy what I played of New Vegas. I've never finished the game. It just existed in a weird block. I apologize. I swear I am actually trans. So I had a lot of excitement for this franchise. I watched the show and I was pleasantly surprised by it. I think that's sort of the general consensus I've seen, is that most people are like, oh, like this is actually pretty good. Like, as a Fallout fan, it doesn't like fuck a bunch of things up. It feels like there are a bunch of like cool allusions to the game that are like fun for Fallout fans, but like if you're just a normal fucking John Jane Doe or whatever, like you're gonna be able to follow along with most of it. There are a couple things that I think they do expect you to know from the games, like what ghouls are and how certain things work. But for the most part, I thought it followed itself pretty well. The characters are good and entertaining. There are funny jokes. If you're into it, there's a lot of gore. The bloody mess perk is definitely turned on from the way certain characters' heads just completely explode. And I had a lot of fun.
I expected this to be a disaster. The idea that this show is going to be like telling you the origin of the little Pip-Boy character. What's his name? The Vault Boy. That's the story. I was like, that fucking sucks. Eat my ass. And then it's like, oh no, Walton Goggins has got the fucking sauce. My man never misses. I shouldn't have doubted you. I was familiar with your game and I wasn't loyal. I'm sorry, Walton. Always deliver. He rocks. He plays a cruel character in a way I wasn't expecting. I feel like a lot of media, like, they want you to like their protagonists too much, and so they're like, you know, they hold back. But Walton Goggins' ghoul just fucking mutilates a bunch of beloved characters, and he's just a fucking got the stuff. Lucy, the main other protagonist, there's three really, but Lucy is I don't know the actress at all. I don't think, if I've seen her before, I don't recall her. Her eyes take up like 90% of her head. She's like a living anime character. And it's really endearing. And her arc from like complete naivete to like more hardened is really interesting. And I'm interested to see where it goes in the second season.
Ella Purnell is her name. And you would probably most know her as the voice of Jinx in the Arcane TV series.
I do not know her for that. You talked to me about that. I was on an episode of Weekly Manga Recap where you and Nick explained that show to me, but I have not seen it.
God, I don't remember us doing that.
That's very funny. And then there's the third protagonist, who is a member of the Brotherhood of Steel. That's a faction that a lot of people have strong opinions about, that they're overexposed, that the writers don't understand what they're about. The show does fine, I guess. They're kind of like xenophobic weirdos who shoot first and ask questions later. I'm not going to here to quibble with the lore. I know some people are like, oh, the timeline doesn't really make sense for this or that. And it's like, listen, it's like 20 years of video games. I think they did as good a job as can be expected while still trying to tell their own story. Like our experience on Dice Funk, right? We'll you know, be doing our thing, telling good jokes, having cool fights, and then someone will be like, remember in season two, you said that elves, you know, this and that. And it's like, did I though? I don't know if I said that. And, you know, it's just hard to keep all that shit straight. I think they do a fine enough job. I do love the violence. One of my main thoughts about this show, and maybe this is stupid, is why are all the fight scenes in slow motion? Is it a reference to VATS, or is just this creative team only really like slow motion fights?
I think it's because it seems cool, like it reads cool on paper to do it in slow motion, and it can kind of feel like the VATS slow motion thing when you're like watching a bullet slowly go through someone's head or something like that.
It was funny watching this back to back with Civil War, because they both do the terrible violence juxtaposed with like old timey song thing. And it works so much better in Fallout. Maybe it's because I know all these songs already, and so I already have like an emotional connection with them. But I found the usage of the same technique in Civil War pretty grating.
Yeah. I think it worked really well. Ella Purnell as Lucy, I think, is a really fun character. She hits that like lawful good but not in an obnoxious way kind of thing. She has like a bunch of weird eccentricities even within it. She has her little catchphrase of okie dokie, and like she's just an adorable character you like to follow, because like most everyone else in the series is kind of a shithead, which makes sense based on how the Wasteland operates. Being like noble really doesn't, you know, prevail you to a long life or anything like that. So her as being this goody two-shoes who slowly has the world kind of reckoned on top of her and seeing how and how she doesn't change is like kind of satisfying. They touch on a couple things from the Fallout universe, but they leave a couple spaces completely untouched, which I assume is going to be future season stuff. Like they tease super mutants and death claws, but I don't think either really show up in any substantial way, which is like a cool thing, because, you know, it means like they'll have stuff to like focus on next time and like space to still explore things. There's some really Quinn-coded moments that I enjoyed, but I also just avoid it as a survival series by and large. There's some fun celebrity cameos and some not fun ones. Mm-hmm. This show had like a real track record of like, ooh, that's also a problematic actor. Ooh, that one's also problematic. But by and large, I had a lot of fun. And video game adaptations are slowly starting to like even the score a little bit. Like it was pretty heavily like video game adaptations are bad. And like we're slowly getting a couple more to like even the numbers out a little bit. So, you know, maybe there's hope if you're announced, you know, your favorite game franchise is going to get a TV show adaptation. You're like, all right, maybe there's still a chance.
I mean, what do the good adaptations have in common? I feel like just incredible actors like Walton Goggins, or, you know, having Pedro Pascal in The Last of Us. I feel like that's the secret, is if you actually just put talented people on it instead of making, you know, where they were embarrassed of the shit and just putting losers you'd never heard of before.
Sure. I think it also helps to like follow it. One of the complaints, I've never watched the Halo TV series, but one of the complaints I keep hearing about it is it like fundamentally doesn't really get Halo in the way that it feels necessary to. So I think that, you know, the showrunners for Fallout do seem to understand the TV show. So
Yeah, my understanding is that all the writers and the director, Jonathan Nolan, are huge Fallout fans. Like, that's why Westworld has a bunch of Fallout Easter eggs and stuff in it. But it's interesting, Walton Goggins has never played a Fallout and, in fact, made a conscious decision not to, just so he could be the person in the room with a counter, counterpoint opinion and be like, what would a normie think of this? Yes,
and that's great. I think that's super important. Like, I think that adds a lot. Because I do think they cut out some of the parts that would be like obnoxious. There's some stuff they don't really touch on, but other stuff they're like, yeah, you know what? Sure. This, you as an audience member can hear the little sounds you've heard playing the game and get excited and see some of the stuff that like has you, you know, pooping your pants in excitement over all this stuff. And then some stuff we need to make sure non-Fallout fans are also like checking out this show.
Yeah. I do want to say, though, in season 10 of Dice Funk, the villain gives this big speech where they're saying that they have a fiduciary duty to the shareholders to increase profits. And since they are profiteering off a war, they therefore have a legal responsibility and obligation to continue the war forever. And I released that episode way before someone gives that exact speech word for word in the show. Yeah. So let the record show, I did not steal that. My shit came out first.
You're so terrified of ever being like called out for like, someone else did this thing before you. Like, no. I'm proud of you. I will say, if you're looking for me to complain about the show, one thing I'll say is I feel like the last episode, things kind of fall apart a little bit. There's a lot of like, we have to reveal a lot of twists and we have to do a lot of like building for the next season and all these sorts of things. It doesn't like flow as tightly and neatly as the rest of everything else. I like where we got to in the end, but it's a little clumsy to get there. They have to like kind of have like two simultaneous reveals to kind of the same piece of information, and I'm still not entirely sure how well I thought that worked out, but I still think the show did a pretty good job. I'll definitely check out season 2 when it comes out. I hope next season has more dog meat in it. Dog meat criminally underused in this season. That dog doesn't get to do a whole lot.
Quinn, dog meat's not in the show at all. Are you talking about XK404?
CX404. I am talking about CX404. She is called Dog Meat, though, at one point by a character. So she's Dog Meat.
Oh my gosh. I could nitpick too, both spoilers and non-spoilers. The only thing I want to say in the time we have left is this show continues, I think, a pretty rotten tradition of treating raiders as like a separate species of human, that where they're just like violence incarnate and they're not people. I think it's much more interesting in the better Fallout games, and where where raiders who still exist are like people and have motivations and, you know, culture and stuff, and like they do violence because they have to survive, which is fine and a good storytelling engine, as opposed to like the later Fallout games in the show where they are basically animals. They're just non-communicative. I just think it's lazy writing where you just don't have to think about killing them. Because who cares? Uh-huh. They're full of experience points and loot.
Yep. So help me figure out how to get Spit in My Mouth off the show, off the ground, and I'll tell you about all the scenes for the Fallout show I wish I could have happen to me. beyond that, I have nothing else to really add. Good show.
Yeah. So, yeah, this has been your sneak peek of Spewpunk. Normally, I sound good. That's the main difference. But we talk about movies. We talk about Magic the Gathering. We talk about whatever's been happening to us recently. A lot of fun stuff. I have more stories from this hell week that I'll do soon. So we'll go be back to it.
We're going to have to talk about the Sonic the Hedgehog cookbook sometime soon as well.
Yep. There's some new music I want to talk about. There's other movies I've seen. But yeah, we got to wrap this one up. So for this weekend, on your regularly scheduled Sunday upload, instead of the new episode of Dice Funk, you are going to be getting a second episode, the second installment of our one-shot series, Pokemon Revolutions, which is a series of one-shots in different game systems depicting the Pokemon uprising as they overthrow the yoke of humanity who has oppressed them for too long. The first one, Quinn, you were in it. You played a Krogunk who took down some cops.
I was gonna say, all I recall was I did a lot of violence. I think I hit Nurse or Officer Jenny with a bench at one point.
You fucked up Officer Jenny for real. So these are all standalone. That's the current plan. I'm just going to release them as I record them when we need them. But they're just different teams of Pokemon as Revolution breaks out all over the Kanto region. We'll probably do other regions as well. But guest starring Conrad Zimmerman. It's a really fun episode. And of course, it's going to be Jane and Laura, who we love, wife and wife, back at it again. So that's what you're going to hear this Sunday. And then next week, we'll be back with Dice Funk to see them sneak across the farm and get back to the Well of Resurrection. So that's where we are. Thank you for listening. Thank you all so much for supporting the show. For being so generous with helping me with my computer situation. It's the whole reason the show is possible. It's not an exaggeration. If you all didn't help out, the show would end and stop forever. So thank you so much. Do you have anything else to add, Quinn? I can feel the light fading from my eyes.
Just leave an emoji if you want more episodes of Spit in My Mouth. I don't know which one would be the right one. I guess there's like a water drop emoji and then put like lips next to it. Then I'll be able to read into that and figure out the clue, right?